there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 265. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can stroll on over to Twitter, type in This Show Is So Gay, that's our handle, follow us there. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A most fun show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Tyler Curry is the senior editor and head writer of HIV Equal Online, World Health Clinician's premier online magazine. Tyler is a nationally syndicated columnist who continues to write for a variety of LGBT lifestyle and travel magazines. Prior to joining the team at World Health Clinicians, Tyler started his own HIV awareness campaign entitled The Needle Prick Project, which we're going to talk all about. This photo and editorial campaign received national attention as one of the first of its kind to focus on eliminating HIV stigma. Tyler has written more than 50 columns that have been published across the globe, and now he's here with us. Tyler Curry, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hello, thank you.
Well, let's just call out the elephant in the room. How jet-lagged are you right now?
I don't even know how jet-lagged I am. Like, I don't even know what time zone it is. I don't even know what day it is. I've been traveling for 5 weeks, so this is just, I'm finally finished. I get to go home tomorrow for a whopping 5 days before I do it all over again, so I'm really excited.
Wow. And so you were in Zimbabwe?
Yeah.
And what were you doing there?
Zimbabwe with HIV Equal World. It's a section of our website that focuses on the climate of stigma abroad. And we are also promoting a new program that World Health Clinicians is starting called the Guardian Program. It's actually called the Guardian Angel Program. And it is an opportunity for people across the world to sponsor children who have lost their funding for their education, which is only $25 a month. So these people can follow this child as they re-enter the education process and follow their success and get to know them a little better. It's a really cool program.
Nice, nice. Well, let's go back a spell. Let's start out. You are, by birth, a Texan?
Yes.
And I inferred online you love when people ask you where your accent is.
Yeah, it's so silly. I mean, I'm from Dallas, and I do have one. It only comes out with a little bit of whiskey, but, you know, one thing I get is they'll be like, wow, I can't believe you admit to that, or something along that effect, like just kind of being like, Texas sucks. And, you know, there are good and bad qualities to every culture. I think people from the South are extremely polite, and I'm very proud to be a Southerner. So,
nice.
Yeah, I mean, people are always asking me, like, why don't I leave Texas and move to L.A. or New York, where most of my work is done? And I was like, well, then if people like me and other gay men and women didn't stay in Texas and then just gave it away to the people that we're fighting against, then that would be kind of like a pretty big sign of defeat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although there are all those stereotypes present, I'm sure you get them all the time, that Texans and the South in general just not LGBT friendly. What has been your experience?
Okay, well, Austin is like the People's Republic of Texas, so it's like an island in the middle of Texas, so that doesn't really count. You know, any urban area is gay friendly.
Yeah.
And think about Texas, it's just so large. I mean, I do come from a cattle farm. I had 4 cows growing up, and it's like paid for some of my college, but I still reside in Dallas, and Dallas is very gay friendly.
Yeah.
We almost had a gay mayor. I worked on his campaign, in college, and we went down to a runoff, and you know, just being so close, I mean, you can't say that Texas, which houses 5 major urban areas, is all one way.
Right.
All, none of it's gay-friendly. You know, that's kind of ridiculous. That's like saying the United States isn't gay-friendly. The difference between Kentucky versus, you know, Massachusetts, there's differences.
All right. So it was okay for you there in the Texas, and because in my world, cattle farm, that's a metaphor. But for you, it was real.
It's real, and it was, you know, I could go into issues. I grew up Church of Christ, and yes, there was definitely, there still is contention in my family, but, you know, that's not exclusive to Texas people. My mother and my sisters are my biggest support group. They all love my boyfriend and want me to marry him as soon as possible, which there's no rush, but it's just like anywhere. You know, people are people, and there are great people who are supportive and educated and smart, and there are, you know, the others.
Indeed.
That just take time.
Indeed, indeed. Well, let's flash forward. We're going to flash forward to 2012. And anybody, all of our listeners, you should just go online and Google reluctant social commentary of a newly HIV-positive 20-something. You can find it. It's right there online. This was a pivotal moment for you, putting this out there. From doing all my research on you and reading all of your columns and whatnot, this was kind of a watershed moment for you to write this column and have that be a launching pad.
Yeah, that definitely changed everything for me.
What led you to penning this piece?
Well, I found out that I was HIV positive in July of 2012. And I went through the experiences that you could imagine,
yeah.
You know, shame, fear. I was nervous about dating and telling my family. But slowly and surely, I started telling a couple of people that were important in my life. I told my sister and a handful of friends, one being my roommate at the time. And, you know, he was a nurse, so I really thought I could trust that he'd be confidential. And I don't even, like, I'm not even mad at him now because I understand, like, people, it's just a natural reaction. Like, people share things and they, you know, make mistakes. But anyways, he started to share my story around town, and not in the very nicest way, using HIV, telling people that I was positive to kind of put me down in the dating pool, right? So, well, I found this out actually because I told my best friend I was positive, and he already knew because he had heard it from around town.
Wow.
So, I mean, I've never been one to kind of take anything lying down, so I decided, actually, you know what, I don't even know what I was thinking. Like, I just woke up one morning at 2 a.m. and I started writing. I was already a writer. I worked as a marketing writer, and I had written some op-eds before, but nothing obviously to this effect. And so it took me 2 weeks to write it all out. I was terrified of it once I finished. Didn't know what to do with this piece that I had written, but everything was on there, like my heart and my soul and my humor and my wit and everything that I wanted people to know I still had was on that piece of paper.
Yeah.
Virtual piece of paper. And I sent it out to the Advocate and Huffington Post, and I told myself if nothing national wants to publish it, then it's not good enough, and I'll just file it away, and that'll be that. And it published in both magazines in 2 days. So then everything was just, you know, like, and then it went from 0 to 100.
Yeah.
I went from 5 people knowing to, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 to, you know, who knows how many.
Yeah, you wrote in that piece, quote, "This article is my way of taking off the mask and opening up a dialogue." It certainly did that, Tyler.
It still is. That's kind of the piece that everyone remembers. And, you know, it does feel like a mask. And, you know, it's really, I always joke with my French friends, like, I'm the HIV whisperer. Because since then, I've had so many people in the community reach out to me through Facebook or Twitter who want to talk. And I am all for that. But I am not their friend. And
right.
I don't mean that in a mean way. Like, they don't know me. I can't be there for them.
Right.
And so, of course, I talk, but the only advice I can really give is you have to open up about this. Like, you have to reveal who you are to the people that you love so they can, you know, be your support. That's the only way you're going to get through this, because it's kind of like coming out of the closet. Like, once you say it, all of those fears and ideas that you had about what would happen, they all go away, and, you know, you return to normal life.
Yeah.
Nothing's ever, you know, the same, but you get back to just being you.
Yeah. Well, in that piece, you also address that central HIV paradox right now. You wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, avoiding the topic couldn't be any easier than it is now. Long gone are the visible signs of disease, such as muscle wasting, sunken faces, and distended bellies. In the days of drug cocktails, medications weren't as precise, and many physical signs associated with HIV were side effects of earlier drugs. Not anymore. HIV medical researchers have become so accurate at pinpointing the virus that any collateral damage done to the body has been drastically reduced to almost non-existent." So you have, on the one side, yay for advances in medicine, but then you appropriately highlight, and we can avoid talking about it as much as we did because the physical signs aren't there.
Right. You know, it's difficult because I just wrote this piece for Huffington Post called Fingers to Ashes, and what inspired it is this kind of phenomenon that's happening right now where people who lived through the actual, you know, I'm going to call it a plague because that's what it felt like.
I mean,
there was no answer. There was no understanding. People were just dying. It was immensely sad and heartbreaking. And the people that lived through that, I think once it finally, like, I remember hearing these stories, like one day you just opened the newspaper and there was no longer any obituary to write. But, you know, a year before, you had to pick which one of your friend's funeral you were going to go to.
Yeah.
And so there was just this huge presence of HIV in everyone's life. And once it was managed, people didn't want to talk about it anymore.
Right.
And so now the people that would carry that torch, most of them are dead. And the ones that were also around, like, they're not wanting to talk about it because it brings a painful memory. So what happened? A 20-year-old gay man is not equipped with the culture or the history or the knowledge. And people that are positive now are looking just as good as he is. So, you know, there's really this huge disconnect between the problems that face an LGBT kid today versus the fear of what HIV looks like and those images that we still have burned in our brain,
right?
You know, of yesteryear.
Totally. Well, you dove right in to tackle this issue of stigma with the Needle Prick Project. For folks who don't know about it, how would you describe it to them?
I would just call it, I mean, it was a visual and editorial media campaign.
Yeah.
It started by total accident. I realized that there was nothing really special about my story. It was just that I told it, and I told it in a way that wasn't so depressing or sad. You know, it was at times funny, at times, you know, sarcastic, and people, I think, really wanted to hear that. And so I started the editorial campaign, which was just a profile series of other people sharing their stories. And I created this image with the red Band-Aid, my picture with the red Band-Aid. And I realized that not everyone might have a story, but everyone can take a pledge to be a part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started the photo campaign to incorporate people and have them, you know, every photo, in my opinion, was a pledge to take up the responsibility to talk about HIV. And it's not something that's so, you know, heavy. You can talk about it. You know, I was trying to encourage, like, casual conversation, brunch table conversation, cocktail conversation. Not so serious.
Right. Yeah, it's very – I just got back, as our listeners know, because we talked about it on last week's show, just from the San Francisco to L.A. AIDS ride, and it's just always amazing to me.
I was there, too.
Okay, how did we not run into each other? What were you doing? Were you riding?
I was in the media tent the whole time.
Look at you. I was on a gear truck. And so as you were present as well, and as we talked about on last week's show, just a whole range of conversations on HIV and AIDS, you know, ranging from, I mean, kind of where we are right now of the normal heart coming out and having those conversations, but also just being a part of quite a few conversations for not to lump us together, Tyler, but for folks who, like us, who are under 40, who are, as I said last week, too old to not know what happened in the early 80s, but maybe too young to have gone to all of those funerals, because that's just not the age that we were. And so we live at kind of that nexus of having these conversations, and any attempts to make them lighter or to give people more access points, like the Needle Prick Project did, that's a good thing.
You know, it's really difficult because there was only one measure to really attack a virus that you knew was sexually transmitted, but you didn't know that much more.
Right.
And so you just struck the fear of God into anybody that you could.
Yeah.
And then handed them a condom and hope for the best. And that's not the case anymore. You know, PrEP is out and everyone is debating about PrEP. But another thing that people don't talk about enough is PrEP would not be, and I'm going to say this.
Go for it.
Because I know that I can. PrEP would not even be needed if everyone who is positive right now was on their medication and compliant, if everyone in the country took their pill a day, or maybe it was two pills a day, and achieved an undetectable viral load, they would not be able to transmit the virus and PrEP would not be needed. Now, only 25% of people who are positive are managing their disease correctly. Managing sounds like a big word. All it is taking your pill with your breakfast in the morning.
Right.
And so, like, there's this huge obstacle we have in front of us is to update the messaging of, you know, quit enough with all the fear and enough with all the slut shaming. And someone who would take PrEP, you know, is someone who is admitting to being irresponsible. No, that's someone that's actually being honest with themselves, because clearly transmission rates have been steady way before PrEP. So people are, you know, not always using condoms. And this whole morality issue around sex is just, that's really what's perpetuating the transmission.
Yeah. Well, that brings us right to the current project of HIV Equal. How did you become associated with this whole publication?
Well, they kind of found me. I saw that they were doing, you know, something different. At first I was like, who the hell do they think they are? Like, you know.
Right.
But then I realized that they had combined testing with these photos, which I thought was just so brilliant. I did really love the messaging. I think the term HIV Equal is just, you know, ingenious. And whenever I was out in New York in March with my boyfriend, they invited me to come and take a photo with them. And so whenever I did, I talked to the founders of World Health Clinicians, and I had kind of been working on this idea of this comprehensive website or online magazine that really kind of bridged the gap between some of, like, the medical information that's kind of a total swallow. You know, like, nobody reads that for fun.
Right.
And, you know, some really great editorial content that humanizes the disease or the virus, and it's popular, and, you know, and goes viral. So that's what we're trying to do right now.
Well, you just did your first op-ed, which is very exciting. And in the introduction, you wrote this. You wrote, "To every newly positive man who looked at me with defeat, asking how I can be so confident while so many judge, we are all equal. To every long-term survivor that doubted if my steadfast determination to not let my diagnosis break my stride would last, we are all equal. And to every queen who scoffed at the notion that we were equal until he received a positive diagnosis, we are all equal." How excited are you to work with this project? It just comes across in every word, but I'll let you tell everyone.
No, it's honestly a dream come true. I had been wanting to do something like this, and to give me the opportunity basically to say, like, here's what you need, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Recruiting other writers and exploring other topics. We have some really cool concepts coming up, some like short little vignettes that are going to be very funny and scripted and with people that you know. And, you know, it really is. It's so funny. People are so confused whenever I say that I won't say that being positive was the best thing that ever happened to me, but coming out about it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Whenever you live an honest life and you just do what you love to do, you go through struggles, but it always makes your life better. And I have to say, like, I'm doing everything, you know, I just came back from Zimbabwe to report on the struggles that this other culture is going through. And, I mean, it's hard to even call this work for me.
Right.
And I'm working a lot.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
It doesn't feel that way.
How do you, because one of the stated goals is to put out a publication that is both youthful and comprehensive. How do you create a strategy that reaches out to a more youth-centered population?
I think you create it's not even a strategy. You get the youth involved.
Yeah.
You get them writing. Everyone is a writer if they want to be. And this young kid named Nicholas Napoli, who's 20 years old, who lives in Dallas as well, didn't know him at all. We just live in the same city. He wrote his first op-ed for our publication, and he found out he was positive after his first boyfriend at 19.
Wow.
And he is a young, attractive, cute, smart kid with his whole life in front of him, and he still does have his whole life in front of him, but he had to overcome an obstacle that a lot of young kids don't. And so I think showing, once again, like, you know, whenever I tell my story, I was a 28-year-old man. I wasn't 19. Other 28-year-olds and maybe above or younger could understand. But I guarantee you, an 18-year-old would have read my story, and, or not even read it. You're like, that's not me. That guy's old. And so you empower, you get them to read it by empowering them and giving them a voice. And that's, you know, what we're trying to do. It's not even just about being positive. We want people who are HIV negative to write about maybe their journey about learning about HIV, the first time they were confronted with someone who was positive, and maybe they responded the right way. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they realized that they didn't afterwards, you know, whatever story they have.
Nice. Nice. Well, how can folks get involved with this project?
They can go to HIVequal.org and check it out, and they can sign up for the newsletter. They can also follow the Instagram. You're going to ask me this, of course, after I'm jet lagged and I'm not on my computer. But,
we're going to link to it for everyone, so that'll be fine.
Okay, I think it's just HIV Equal. I think like, everything is HIV Equal.
Now, we've had Dr. Gary Blick on the show. That guy's got some stories.
Yeah, he does. I heard a lot of them in Africa.
I bet. Oh, I would imagine it was incredible traveling with him.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What is your plan to overcome this jet lag?
You know, okay, so I'm going to tell you what a little project I'm doing.
I'm excited.
I'll have to say it really worked out. So, not to totally derail this topic, but I'm coming up on my father's, like, one-year anniversary of his passing, and he passed away from alcoholism. So,
okay.
Like, I've been on this 30-day alcohol-free project to kind of evaluate my relationship with alcohol, how it affects my productivity, my health, my mood, and it just so happened it started before AIDS life cycle, so I've gone through all of this trip. And I wasn't a heavy drinker ever, but, you know, of course, a glass of wine here, whiskey there, you know, I'm a normal 30-year-old man. That has changed everything. Like, I've just been drinking a lot of water, and the jet lag has not been that bad.
All right.
Yeah. I'm writing a big story about the relationship with alcohol in the gay community for The Advocate, so you can check it out. It's coming out in July.
That is very exciting. I mean, that's a particular research topic for me, because there are all the assumptions out there that it is an integral piece of our community, when in fact, you know, it really doesn't have to be.
Well, it doesn't have to be, but of course it is, because our community was born in gay bars.
Yes.
Like, you know, we congregated in the places that we felt safe, and, you know, our entire culture was started in an alcoholic environment to escape, to let loose, to numb yourself from all the things that you're going through. And of course, we've grown and we've split off, but it definitely is kind of like the gay bars are the heartbeat of the gay culture. And you can argue with me that you aren't part of that, but you can definitely, it doesn't take a lot to just view the gay culture and see it.
Yeah.
And so it's a good topic to talk about.
Well, excited for that piece to come out. Let me just also throw this random bit of ephemera out at you. Every now and then I'm always looking for a new workout, and I see things online, and they either inspire me to try it, or in the case of something you put out there, there's not a chance that I am doing this gymnastics thing that I read about you doing online, because that was not going to happen, Tyler.
Well, and honestly, it was not hard. I mean, I was a gymnast until I was in college, so I was fun for me, but I can tell you there was like every different level. It's basically like taking CrossFit, but all of the bad parts of it out. Because for CrossFit can be really bad if you're not paying attention in the form, because you're using a lot of weight. In gymnastics, you're using your body weight, and you're using balance. And it's kind of like CrossFit yoga is how I would best describe it. And it was fun. I'm actually headed out to San Francisco to try this high altitude fitness training. They simulate high altitude, and you train. I guess you like pass out because it's so hard. And supposed to make you stronger, so I'll tell you how that goes. Try that.
Yes, please write a follow-up piece to another workout that I will never try. So if folks want to learn about that, you can just go over to the HuffPo and type in Putting the Gym in Gymnastics, subtitled Things Ken Won't Do. All right, folks should stroll on over to HIVequal.org. I love any campaign that's reaching out to youth. I love any campaign that's addressing stigma, and I love any campaign that is as accessible as this one clearly is. So looking forward to great things from you, Tyler, and everybody working over there on the HIV Equal campaign.
Awesome. Thank you for having me on your show.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second guest. Jay Rizzo-Mertz is a former candidate who sought to represent the people of the 100th District in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives in the 2014 election. He is a former senior fellow at the Walker Center for Civic Responsibility and Leadership at Millersville University and has worked as a consultant and a small business coordinator. I followed his campaign online and was quite a bit fascinated by it, and thus most pleased that he's here with us today. Rizzo, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So much to talk about. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Now, you are, from what I'm gathering, a proud Pennsylvanian.
I am indeed, born and raised.
What is life like in your corner of Pennsylvania?
Oh, I live about 10 miles north of the Maryland border and at my cozy little corner of Lancaster County. It's very pleasant. I have to say that the scenery is quite a change from my days living in West Philadelphia, which I spent a little bit of time in. But I've always lived fairly close to the Susquehanna River, and I'm kind of a child of the river, and I absolutely love the region. And it's just, you know, the people are nice for the most part. you know, every state has their oddballs, but that's what makes it beautiful. But, it's pleasant to have a little bit of peace and quiet, these days as opposed to, city living.
That's Amish country, is it not?
It is. I actually am surrounded by Mennonite farms. It's kind of interesting. I wake up some mornings and I smell chickens. Other times I smell cows. I see horses running all over the field. It's quite tranquil most of the time down here.
That's all I know is the Amish and Franklin and Marshall University, and that's it.
Ellicott County does have a large Amish population. That's definitely for sure. And in my 27 years of being on this earth, I've had a great deal of contact with the Amish Mennonite communities, and they've always been a really, really interesting group of people to converse with and I guess observe from a distance, because their culture is, you know, it's very fascinating to me, and I've always grew up being around them, and they're really interesting people. They're really good-hearted, and I like being their neighbors because they always have animals around, which I'm a huge fan of, and it adds a little bit of an extra dimension to country living to have so many livestock around.
I'm going to let you do it, and then every now and then report back to me, and then I will live through you without having to actually do it.
That works. That's
okay.
No problem.
I like our deal. Yeah. Well, let's talk about you, because you just mentioned 27 years old. I'm always just such a huge fan of youth involvement, and you do count as youth, and you can accept that or deny it, but it's my show, so you got to accept it. And the idea of youth getting involved in public policy work, because I think that that's one of the huge keys. So let's talk about what led you to where you ended up this past year. So growing up there, and you're very open on your website there, and folks can stroll on over to electjrizzomertz.com and learn more about you there, that had some brushes with the law growing up.
I have. Yes, I have. I had my stint where I was exercised some poor judgment, and as a younger man, I grew up not really having a stable father figure in my life. I went through two divorces, saw my mother and my father divorced when I was 8, which was a very ugly affair, and then I experienced my stepfather and my mother go through their rather rough divorce as well. You know, I didn't really have any individual, like I say, a father figure to basically help show me the ropes and learn life's lessons. So I had to kind of learn them on my own a little bit. And learn them I did. Because everyone's going to learn the lessons of life one way or the other. And I chose the hard way, apparently. I was raised to be, to give to others and to be an upstanding young man and conduct myself as a gentleman. And I kind of lost my way for several years, leaving high school and going into college. But a couple, that was about 3 or 4 years ago, I had one of those come to Jesus moments when I realized that I was throwing my life away, living for, in the moment, instead of actually living up to my potential. So I really did a lot of self-reflection, and I came to peace with my past and made amends with those I've wronged, and atoned for my wrongheadedness, and basically just hit the ground running and to show people that, I can be taken seriously, and I'm here to be a better man and a better citizen, and to share my experiences that I have acquired throughout my life, and in order to help others who may be going through a similar situation that I have.
Totally.
Because there's many teachable moments in that, and I want to be able to share a little piece of my wisdom and to help others.
Plus, I bet it made you a superstar on the mock trial team, which, by the way, I'm obsessed with mock trial. I think it's the greatest thing ever.
Absolutely. I learned a great deal through personal experience and also through reading a lot of law books. I have become a kind of like one of those kitchen cabinet lawyers where I wish I could practice the law, and I wish I had a law license to be able to be a counselor in a courtroom. But the way the economy is, I'm holding off on law school. But I do appreciate and understand and just how awesome the legal practice is and how fascinating the law is. But the mock trial was a lot of fun. I brought a lot of heat to the courtroom.
I bet you did. Now, you went to Millersville University, and it looks to me from reading your bio and just knowing some about you that getting involved with the Walker Center for Civic Responsibility and Leadership was pretty pivotal for you.
Yes, absolutely. Because that's basically what steered me. We can all talk about politics and policy and engagement all we want. Basically, you got to put that into action in some way, shape, or form. And what the Walker Center is continuing to do to this day is it basically foster college-age individuals to not only understand and have a passion for public policy and civics and politics, but to actually go out and help out at the polling stations and helping people vote, helping with basically taking political polls, engaging public opinion, things of that nature, understanding the whole process, talking to flesh and blood people about issues, and also talking to officials and lawmakers who will be able to put those the ideas of policy into a reality. So what I learned from the Walker Center was basically, I had the knowledge, and they provided me with the tools that I needed to in order to, aptly engage in other individuals. So basically, after that, after graduation, I realized that, well, we can take that, off the college campus and put it into the communities and just get people fired up with, instead of, yelling at your television set from the couch, why don't you go out and go to a township meeting or go to a rally that might be being held in Harrisburg or Philly or what have you. You got to get involved. You can't be, politics is not a sideline sport. And that's one of the lessons I'm every day that I try to teach people, that you have to get involved. And it's not just casting a ballot once a year or twice a year if you vote in the primary. It's being constantly engaged in your communities in order to better it. You can't have other people do the work for you. Sometimes you have to lift your finger and, roll up your sleeves and get the work yourself. And that's the lesson I want people to take away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's flash forward, because somewhere in the mix, after all of these different formative experiences, you said, I want to serve the public. I want public office. I'm going to seek out that route. How did that even come about?
Well, my political opponent, Representative Brian Cutler, is actually a friend of mine, you know, on a personal level. When we eat lunch about on and off, but I would say probably about once a month we meet and just, you know, sometimes we don't even talk about politics, but basically it was, you know, after Corbett took office and, you know, and after the 2010 election and realizing that it's, you know, in the course of one election, the course of the state of affairs in a state, like, for example, Pennsylvania, for this example, can take such a turn for the worse that if people fall asleep at the wheel when it comes to voting and you allow individuals to be elected that are too extreme and their policies are really far out there, if you really look at things, and you see how things just kind of can go to hell in a handbasket real quick. Like in the course of just 2.5 years, Pennsylvania went from 7th to 49th in job creation. That's a short amount of time and a huge, you know, plummet. And something so vital, you know, after the greatest economic downturn since the 1930s. So basically, I realized that our generation, there's so many issues that affect the younger generation that we've got to get involved in more ways than just, like I said, even just, you know, community service or going to meetings or what have you. Sometimes you have to throw your hat in a ring and make that plunge and run for public office. And so, you know, living in 100th District, my alma mater, Millersville, is included in that district. So I realized that maybe this is my, you know, my chance, you know, where I can throw my hat in there and maybe do some good. If not win, maybe at least raise awareness on the issues that are absolutely important to people.
Yeah.
And to hear what, you know, what concerns them the most. And, you know, so I talked to my closest, friends and my family, and they all knew that I was destined for this kind of stuff, apparently, because they said I'd be foolish not to do it, because, as they say, you are born to do stuff like this. They're amazing people that I have in my life. And that's kind of how that came about, where I just, you know, kind of put my money where my mouth is and made that fateful decision to file paperwork and run for the House Representative seat that Cutler holds.
And for folks who have not been tracking how the election went, walk us through kind of the narrative of where you ended up now.
Sure. Like I started my campaign fairly early in the game, September of 2013. You know, being a first-time candidate, you know, it's very difficult running for office in any regard. It's very difficult to do. But running for an office for example, in a General Assembly is immensely difficult.
I bet.
So you have all this paperwork that you have to try to understand, you know, because sometimes individuals like myself don't have access to attorneys that specialize in election. Like, there's a whole set of election law and lawyers who exclusively practice election law, because there's just so much to understand. And if you foul up just once, you know, it can look really bad. So, you know, going through that process, all the paperwork, you know, to file and basically try to, you know, register a political committee and before you can even go in and start fundraising, which that was pretty much what I spent a good majority of my time
doing. Oh, yeah.
Was talking to people with the aim of trying to get a donation from them and then, you know, and just, you know, trying to actively fundraise and trying to tie in, you know, like issue advocacy and things of that nature in the fundraising. Because one of the first major decisions I made for my campaign was to forego any type of corporate donations. I didn't want to have any corporate political action committees, you know, donating to my campaign. And the reason for myself doing that is actually very simple. I don't want to be beholden to CEOs or shareholders of corporations. I want to be beholden to the individual citizen, the individual voter, you know, the people, because when an individual politician is beholden to the people, that's when they're the most honest. That's when they're going to more truly represent the interests of the district that they're, you know, and the people that they represent.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, if I were to go the other way and sell myself off the corporate interest, yeah, that's the easy way out. Yeah, you can get a lot of money that way as a politician, but at the end of the day, you know, a lot of people now view you as a sellout, or, you know, as someone who's going to enable the corporate agenda, and you see what these massive corporations are already doing, you know, with the Citizens United decision, and the McCutcheon decision. It's just, you see what money in politics does, and you see its corrosive influence. So I wanted to basically personify my principle of getting money out of politics by basically taking, you know, the right step in the right direction, I should say, by foregoing corporate donations and relying solely on individual people who would like to donate, you know, from their own pocketbooks to my campaign. It was very grassroots oriented. It was, you know, I kept things very small. I'm a very frugal individual when it comes to that. And basically, on the flip side, though, my opponent he has donations from Coke Industries, from, you know, PPL, you know, some really big name in lobbyist firms and things of that nature. So he was working with thousands of dollars, and you know, here I was happy raising just a little under $1,000, which for a first-time candidate, I can say, you know, it's very difficult to do that, but to raise a little less than $1,000 in my first ever political run, that said something. And
yeah.
I was raising money, you know, from, you know, throughout the country. You know, I had friends in California, Kansas, Florida, you know, a lot of friends throughout Pennsylvania. And, you know, just to have that kind of support where people will have your back because they believe in you was very, I was honored. I was touched. And it was such a, to this day, it's very humbling for me to even think about that. People would be so willing to give me a portion of their hard-earned money to help me out and to have their, you know, their faith in what I believe. To this day, it was such a rewarding experience, and it's something I will always remember.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Talk to me about being an out candidate.
That was very interesting. I have no regrets in doing that. And if my memory serves me correct, not only was I the first Democrat to run in my district since 1969, I'm also, I believe, the first openly gay candidate for the state house in all of Lancaster County history.
Wow.
My records are correct. I had an immense amount of support throughout the county, throughout the state of Pennsylvania as well. And you're obviously going to have your few detractors. You know, there wasn't a week that went by where I wouldn't get an email from an individual who just felt that who I was a, you know, was, I'll paraphrase, an abomination, you know, to use a little bit of a softer word. There's a few out there who chose to use some more saltier language, but if that's what they believe, that's what they believe. I feel a little sorry for them for having such a closed mind that they would, without even meeting me in person, they would just shoot out an email or what have you, other kind of communication, just, you know, letting me know that kind of thought process. Because, you know, the area I live in is very conservative. I will give it that. And I knew what I was doing when I made the decision to run as an openly gay candidate. Otherwise, I wouldn't be being honest with myself. I wouldn't be honest to my partner of 4 years, who I love immensely. Like, I wasn't going to ask him to hide. He's a human being. He's a person too with feelings. And if I'm out to advocate for LGBT rights and to be that advocate, I need to live up to the standard that, you know, individuals like Harvey Milk put forward, where you have to have the courage to take a stand and to do good. And it was, you know, looking back, it was, you know, it was an easy decision for me to make. You know, hands down. Like I said, I have no regrets in doing that. And, you know, walking around, you know, the county nowadays, you know, there's a few people who recognize me, and, you know, I get, you know, nice handshakes, pat in the back, and I get a few, you know, stares that that are not so friendly. But you got to take the good with the bad.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was an absolutely rewarding experience, and it was. I'm just trying to do good in the world and stand up for those who may not have found their courage yet. So if I can help them in any small way, I've accomplished something.
Absolutely. Well, on May 23rd, you were informed by the Lancaster County Board of Elections that you did not have enough votes to be on the ballot. How did you work through that, even just in your own mind, before you even told everybody else?
The first feeling was obviously disappointment.
Right.
Having poured my entire being into this endeavor for 8 months, almost 9 months. I lived, this life for close to 9 months, and just have it, abruptly end, in a blink of an eye, in a simple, sentence, was, it's crushing.
Yeah.
But Barack, President Barack Obama, and a lot of other great leaders out there as well, they were not always successful.
No.
And the lesson that needs to be learned is that there's other elections, there's other opportunities. It's what you learn at the experience that you're having at hand, and what you do with that in the future is what matters. So having said that, my next run for office, I'm confident to be so much more successful, because now I understand what I got myself into, what I will be getting myself into. I won't be, grasping in the dark, trying to find my way all the time. I now know how the process works. I know how the system operates, and I know what is, what the best practices are, and I learned so much, in the entire experience, and met so many amazing people who, in the future, I know are going to have my back. Just the immense network that I was able to bring together and grow is just absolutely wonderful. And to have sitting lawmakers send you private messages of encouragement and of a job well done. You gave it your all, even though you weren't successful, but you gave it your all. To have individuals like that who went through what I went through, to understand what I went through and to send those kind of well wishes, it put my mind at ease, and then I was able to get past my disappointment pretty quickly. Like I'm a pretty resilient guy. Like I bounce back pretty quick. I don't dwell too much on the past. I'm fixated on the future, and I take what I learned from the past and what I'm learning in the present, and I apply that to the future. And I'm absolutely confident that you will see a much stronger candidate, an individual in future runs. And I absolutely look forward to my next opportunity.
I was going to ask, and I felt like I didn't even need to, will there be another run in your future? But I had no doubt that there would be.
Oh, there's going to be, definitely. I'm not going away anytime soon. There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
That's fantastic. Well, right there on your website, you have this quote from John F. Kennedy. Let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer, but the right answer. Let us not seek to fix the blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future. Why put that quote on there?
That quote really gets me. I absolutely love and admire the legacy of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. That quote, I feel like it's so absolutely appropriate in the day and age that we live in this country, where instead of our leaders reaching across the aisle and trying to get something done for the common good and for the public best interest, we see them, a lot of them, blindly holding on to their party ideology or their personal ideology. That's not leadership. What John F. Kennedy was talking about is leadership. It's, taking responsibility for what you're going to do about the future, what you're doing in the present, and forgetting what slights you may have had in the past, what difficulties you may have experienced. And it's just remaining absolutely fixated on the prospect of what can be accomplished in the future. Like, what can we do if we work together? What at the end of the day, we're so much stronger together when we unite as Americans, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, not as Libertarians or Independents or Socialists or Green Party or whatever your political stripe may be. But when we come together as one people, as one American people, we can accomplish great things. I think of all the presidents in modern American history, I think John F. Kennedy understood that a lot better than a lot of others, I feel, because he also gave that famous line, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. And it is the test of our abilities. It's an idea we do not postpone." You know, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. He is able to bring the country together not only for the betterment of the United States of America, but for the betterment of humanity. Because that's kind of also what we do as well. We not only make our country better when we unite as one people, we can show the world what can happen with that unity, and humanity benefits from that. So I, as a politician or as a public official or a public servant, whatever, you know, the correct terminology to describe someone like myself would be these days, I like to channel President Kennedy, because I just truly feel that if we work together and look past what you know, our party lines, or, you know, the gridlock, the polarization, the white noise that the media spits out every day, we can become a great nation once again. We can be an example to aspire to for the rest of the world. You know, we can just be able to care for our most vulnerable citizens, lift up the poor. We can build absolutely amazing monuments of industry and commerce and science and technology. We can ensure that our next generation have the education that they deserve, that, you know, like individuals like myself received, and so that they're properly prepared for the future, that they can follow their dreams just like I am.
Yeah.
We need to be able to care for every generation in this country so that everyone has a chance to live the life in relative comfort and security that I honestly feel that we all deserve as human beings and as American citizens. I know it's a lofty ideal and I may sound a little corny, but it's something I truly believe each and every day. It's something that it's obviously going to be a very, you know, a struggle moving forward. You know, it's not going to be easy, but if more people join individuals like myself, you know, and get involved and not just casting a ballot, but picking up trash or helping children read in kindergarten or public schools, helping a musician find that first that courage to go on stage, to help out with a science fair, to mentor a child, to care for an elderly individual who wants companionship and someone to talk to smile at each other and to say, you know, good afternoon or how are you? Just not, you know, don't be so, you know, have such negativity. Like we all are fighting hard battles.
Right.
We all want something in life. But I think what's really missing in our society nowadays is it's helping one another, not just helping ourselves, but maybe making some sacrifices for, you know, from what we want so that we can bring a smile to someone else's face or bring happiness to others. You know, like that's another thing that I realized that I had to do was sacrifice a great deal of my sanity a little bit, you know, waking up early in the mornings and late at night, to try to get elected. But in order to help others, you have to make some sacrifices. And if other individuals around, you know, look at my example or read about me and what I believe in, I would hope they would come to that same conclusion and take that first step in realizing that life can be better if we take a little bit of time out of our day to just make someone smile.
Yeah.
And that's the lesson that I feel that I was taught through life, you know, coming from a family who's always either been a military or police officers, firefighters, EMTs. It's life can be ugly. And, you know, if you turn on TV, you see that. But life is also just filled with immense beauty. And just, you know, it's like a profound poem that's constantly being rehearsed, you know, verse by verse. And it's, you know, that commercial you used to be like, what would your verse be? I think it's Apple. Something that's as simple and cheesy as that can actually be very profound and teach us a lot of, about ourselves and a lot about how we can live this life and make it a little better for each other. And, you know, I not to, you know, drone on, but the moral of the story is I would gladly give up so much of what I want to do if it's to make the world I live in better by the time I leave it. And that's what I if anyone wants to know anything about me, that's what I want them to take away from that.
And the example that you put forward to everyone and why your campaign struck a chord with me and why we wanted you on the show is because you are one of those shining examples of, look, to make things better, it doesn't require a certain age. It doesn't require a certain sexual orientation. It doesn't require, you know, this is the populist part that you need to live in Pennsylvania, whatever it might be. I think you did so well to challenge those notions. Again, even going into chatting with you today, I had no doubt you would be running for office again, though I am gratified to hear it because I think you do have that embodiment of promise and future and hope out there. And it would be really stupid, and I think you know this, to not keep going with this and not share it with more folks. So, please know that for your next campaign, you always have a spot on our show to come on and give people even more access to just the great ideas that you have out there, because we want you to keep going, man.
Well, I sincerely appreciate that. I would love to be on in the future and keep you and your listeners updated. And I love to have future conversations. I would very much look forward to that.
No pressure, but we expect great things from you.
Oh, man, no pressure at all. I'll be sure to live up to the expectations that people have.
Fantastic. Rizzo, please keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you. Absolutely. I plan on doing that from here on out. Yeah, no worries at all.
All right, folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. To subscribe to This Show Is So Gay, just stroll on over to iTunes. Type in This Show Is So Gay, our show will pop right up, and you can subscribe. And then you don't have to download it every week. It will download automatically for you. Our huge, huge thanks to Tyler Curry and the great work that he is doing over there at HIV Equal Magazine. And, of course, our thanks to J. Rizzo Mertz. Looking forward to his next campaign. My gosh, folks, that would be a 30-year-old and a 27-year-old creating just some amazing change in this world. Let that be a reminder to you that it does not matter how old you are. It does not matter your sexual orientation. It does not matter your political ideology. You can use your voice to make a difference. And I urge you to get out there, use your voice the way that you know how to best use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're out there creating change, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?